Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Darius Rajali, professor of political science at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and author of Torture and Democracy. Dr. Rajali's talk will be given as the Father Henry W. Casper S.J. Professorship in History Lecture, co-sponsored by the Creighton University Department of History. His topic will be The Secret Histories of Modern Torture. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 15, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is John Calvert, Associate Professor of History in the Creighton Department of History and current holder of the Father Henry W. Casper S.J. Associate Professorship in History.
The subject of torture is troubling and unsettling, and it's a topic about which we think we have some understanding. We may not often contemplate the ugly reality of torture, but when we do, invariably we conjure images derived from the medieval or early modern periods or from the dismal archives of the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century. Professor Darius Rajali undermines our certainties about torture. He asks us to focus not on abject medievalism, but on places that at first may not seem obvious. The colonial jails of French Algeria, Northern Ireland's Maze Prison, and Abu Ghraib in American-occupied Iraq. For it's at these and other contemporary sites that the most profound developments in torture's long and dark history unfolded, developments that call into question the boundaries between war and civility, the nature of pain, coercion, and violence, and the very structures that underpin the democratic polities of the West. Darius Rajali has been thinking about torture and its connection to modernity for about three decades now. He is the author of numerous articles, essays, and commentaries on many aspects of torture, as well as the book Torture and Modernity, Self, Society, and State in Modern Iran, published by Westview Press in 1994. However, it's his 850-page study, Torture and Democracy, published by Princeton University Press, 2007, that's brought him to world attention. And it's no exaggeration to say that this work really has transformed conceptions of torture within legal, human rights, and scholarly communities. Torture and Democracy has been described as a superb genealogy of modern torture, a monumental achievement of meticulous documentation, theoretical testing, and reasoned argumentation. Kenneth Roth, executive director of Human Rights Watch, said simply, "It is the best book on the subject that I have encountered." No one, Roth says, should debate the merits of torture without having read it. Torture and Democracy won the 2007 Human Rights Book of the Year Award from the American Political Science Association. It also won the biennial 2009 Raphael Lemkin Award from the Institute for the Study of Genocide, the best nonfiction work in English which addresses the causes of genocide and crimes against humanity. Darius Rajali is professor and chair of political science at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, where he's taught since 1989. He earned his bachelor's degree at Swarthmore and was granted the PhD degree in political science from McGill University in Montreal, where he studied with James Tully and Charles Taylor. I might add that Darius and I were graduate students together at McGill. We were enrolled in different departments, but our interests overlapped. And we discussed over dinner last night how I introduced him at his very first public presentation, which he delivered to faculty and students at the Common Room of McGill's Institute of Islamic Studies. And here I am, some 28 or so years later, introducing him again, this time at the apogee of his career. So as an expression of Creighton's commitment to human rights and the pursuit of global justice, I ask you to welcome Professor Darius Rajali.
So I'd like to thank the Casper Professorship and the Ryan family for the devotion to Creighton. We all know how difficult it is to have speakers come to campus and all the work that John in particular did. None of you know, and probably no point in revisiting this point, but how close it was that I didn't get here yesterday. So there were lots of last-minute challenges, and I'm very grateful to be here. John asked me to speak for 50 minutes, and that's what I will try to do. And hopefully I will finish what I need to say sooner than that. But if not, at least we'll have question time afterwards. As John said, my very first work was on Iran, and I should explain that my interest in torture began because I'm half Iranian, and my first interest in torture arose because I was interested in what accounted for the persistence of torture in Iranian history. I don't come from a family of torture victims. Quite the contrary, I come from a family that probably tortured at some point in its life. So I have a very different way in which I approach this topic. And it's one of those things that I didn't know that I would ever study. I will say this right off the bat. I was a philosophy major. And I didn't really expect that this would be my life work. But it has become so, and I am content with that. Since we're talking about the McGill period, I just want to describe to you what it was like back in the day in the early 80s when I went to see Jim Tully, my dissertation supervisor, and I said, I'd like to work on torture. And he said, well, DeRice, what can we say about it other than it's bad and it should stop? And I said, well, and then I started digging into the question. And there are many, many things one can say about it. Obviously, I couldn't have written an 850-page book if all I wanted to say is it's bad and it should stop. So there are many things that we don't know about torture that we still don't know that a lifetime of research will keep on raising questions for me. The title for today's talk, Secret Histories of Torture, isn't about things that are kept secret from you. It is more about things that are generally unknown about torture, that have often been forgotten about its recent history. And my job is to bring it back, to restore it. And I will be happy to tell you that there will be no pictures and no awful things. What I'd like to talk about just briefly today are four things. The demand for torture, the supply for torture techniques over the last 100 years. I find I can't give talks without talking about whether torture works, so I'll talk a bit about that. And then lastly, some things about American public opinion and torture. And I will go over each of these, and hopefully in each of these sections, I will introduce you to something that most people, regardless of what their views are on torture, they don't know. And hopefully interesting things and not trite things. But before I begin, I'd like to start by just clarifying a few very basic points about torture. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that torture is not merely a policy, or at least we tend to think of torture just as a policy. So we think that when governments change, torture changes. Actually, you know, so when a new president comes, there's a new interrogation policy, torturers retire, scholars like myself get to miss their frequent flyer miles, you know, stuff like that. But that's really not the way it works. Actually, torture practices, which is what I study, change least when during periods of great instability, especially when a country is at war. They change most during periods of stability. This is what my research on Iran, among other things, showed. The great periods of instability are not periods of risk and innovation. The other thing I want to emphasize here is that torture, in my view, is a social practice. And so it lives inside society, not inside the government. The top can authorize that people should use certain techniques. But torture lives on in multiple institutions, and it casts an incredibly long shadow. While it's government that can authorize torture, torture often survives in all sorts of places, in schools, in homes, in military barracks, and so forth. It does not hide in a vault in the CIA. And that's my first point, is that the things that I'm studying are the practices, not what governments say should or could be done. Torture isn't just a policy. My second preliminary point is to basically explain to you what I mean by torture. And for my purposes, what I study is something that meets four criteria. And if it meets these four criteria, then I study it. The four criteria are this. First, it has to involve a state official or a designated state official, either surreptitiously or otherwise, like the head of a death squad. Second, the purpose for which it's being used has to be authorized for state purposes, either intimidation, confession, whether it's false or true, or information. Third, it involves physical coercion that is painful. Fourth, the person to whom it is applied is detained and helpless. I'm not really interested in cases where police must use violence in the course of their lawful activities. I'm not interested in cases of brutality and riots. I'm only interested in cases where the person cannot escape, cannot move, and is subjected to physical pain by a political authority for political purposes. This is, of course, means that what I'm studying is a small part of the history of cruelty. And the history of cruelty is by far greater than the history of torture itself. And there's obviously a relationship. There are many other ways you could slice it, but this is the extremely narrow slice that I look at, something that meets these four criteria: public authority, detained helpless person, physical pain, and public purpose. Now, whatever you want to call things that meet these four criteria, they have a very long history in the world's democracies. From ancient Greece to Rome, to the Renaissance republics of Venice and Florence, and to the great modern democracies. So let me just go on by saying that it's not that democracies don't have a history of torture, but rather that they have a different history of torture, and that's what Torture and Modernity sets out to show. Now, before I speak too badly of democracies, let me explain also that totalitarian regimes and authoritarian regimes really deserve the nasty reputation that they have. There's no question that what they did and what they're historically known for were horrible things, and they deserve the horrible reputations that they have gained over time. However, in the case of democracy, I think the important question is this: not so much whether torture is compatible with democracy, but how has it historically been compatible with democracy? And perhaps the most important claim of torture and democracy, which is this: why is it that democracies have been the great innovators in torture and not authoritarian states in the last 200 years? And that's really one of the central claims that I hope to show you tonight. So let me begin by talking about my first point, which is demand for torture. I'm going to sound like an economist, but I think it's really the simplest way to think about this. There are people who demand torture but don't know anything about what torture is, and there are torturers who learn torture from someone and torture when that demand is there. So we really have two sides of the question, the demand and the supply. And so I want to spend a bit of time to talk about the nature of this demand. So we might think that most cases of torture arise out of national emergencies, certainly in democracies. What other circumstances could we possibly imagine in which torture could happen? Now, the truth, you know, these are the things that you see on 24, the ticking time bomb cases and so forth. But actually, if we look at the broad histories of democracies, I think at best you could make a case that maybe one-third of all the cases of torture we've ever seen in democracies meet that criteria of national emergency, either real or perceived. Actually, there are four other reasons why torture appears in democracies, and these are often reasons that are quite forgotten. First of all, rather common and mundane reason, torture can arise locally in a democracy as a quiet arrangement between police, local businessmen, and homeowners. Homeowners and local businessmen want clean streets, good property prices, and they'll look the other way when the police cleans out the streets, using torture or otherwise. Example, Chicago, 1973 to 1991, a torture crisis that involved close to 50 detectives, most incidents implicating the second in command of the Chicago police, John Burge, and leading to a series of remarkable events, including Governor Ryan suspending the death penalty in Illinois, and now multimillion-dollar lawsuits that the Chicago city councilors or their lawyers are constantly paying out. This is a very common way in which torture appears in democratic cities. Johannesburg, Sao Paulo, Mexico City, they're not all that different from Chicago and the way torture occurs in these countries. Torture can also arise if a system that of law, a judicial system, is permissive. When judges prefer confessions, and they'll accept any confession, they don't really care how the police got it, then the police will get it for you using confessions. And likewise, when judges allow indefinite detention, torture is almost inevitable. Another example from another democracy is the Japanese torture crisis of the 1980s, one that involved ordinary criminals, not terrorist suspects. This is an extraordinary case, and in many ways, very characteristic of the East Asian democracies. You may not know this, but close to 84% of all cases in Japan, all judicial cases in Japan, regardless of the crime, end with a full confession by the accused, which is actually down from the fascist period. Now, when judges demand confessions like this, then not surprisingly, people confess, and possibly the most amazing case that got to the Japanese Supreme Court was a case in which five different people confessed to exactly the same crime, and they all were sentenced for years. So I'm just trying to give you a sense that when judges like confessions, these things can happen too. This is also, by the way, very characteristic of the way in which judges treated confessions in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s before they became somewhat more educated about these things. It's important to recognize that it's not just an East Asian issue. And the fact is that psychological tests that we have out there show that people typically will believe a confession even if they know it's coerced, regardless, and it will influence their judgment. That's a second reason. The third common reason is that torture comes about in democracies when decommissioned soldiers return from war. Again, I'll just give you a story. Imagine that you're a military policeman and you've learned to torture in ways that were expedient to your job, and you now need a civilian job. You've come back. What kind of job are you going to look for? Well, the most obvious options are private security or public policing. And this is how torture often comes back into a society. If you got ahead doing torture, doing one job, you'll use the techniques when you come back home. This has happened twice in French history and twice in American history. And just to give you the American examples, which you might be more familiar with, you all know, you've all heard the word waterboarding. Now, waterboarding doesn't really describe a torture. It's a slang word. There are, I hate to be specific, three different types of water tortures that are typically called waterboarding. So people get confused. But the particular technique that was approved by for usage in the United States, has a long history. And it's not that Americans were unfamiliar with torture during the period of slavery, but this kind of water torture was generally unknown until after 1905, when soldiers from the Philippine-American War returned. And by 1930, it was documented clear across the United States in police stations from east to west, but particularly in the American South. Similarly, the techniques that Commander Burge introduced allegedly into the Chicago police force were first seen in the hands of American soldiers in Vietnam near a post where he was stationed. And likewise, the techniques that appeared in Abu Ghraib are not particularly different from techniques that were used in INS prisons in the 1990s in Miami. So I want to be clear, and just one other thing that should be clear, those traditions still survive. So as late as 1983, there's a case of a sheriff and two deputies in Texas who used exactly the same waterboarding technique to extract confessions out of people, and they were convicted for torture and abuse of public office, if I'm not mistaken. So I think it's important to recognize that we might think that wars end and torture stops, but actually torture does not recognize the line between domestic and international, and what's out there often comes back. And usually, if I read this situation correctly, it takes about 20 years before torture reemerges back in the home country, usually in a neighborhood that is conflict-ridden. That's what the historical record tells us, and that's what I expect will happen to us as well. I have no reason to think otherwise. Lastly, once a government authorizes torture, many people are drawn to government service because they want to be the Jack Bauers of tomorrow. And unless an entire security force decides to torture, a split soon develops between the professionals, interrogators, and the torturers, as happened in the United States between the FBI and the CIA. Sooner or later, one side or the other loses. In the case of Brazil in the 1970s, it was the torturers who lost. And the Brazilian military actually turned on its own torturers because they had essentially become indisciplined, black marketeering, corrupt military squads. And in other cases, the policing professionals lose, and then they leave the agencies in large numbers. So what I would like to be clear is that there are lots of people now who work within military and security agencies who simply believe deeply that torture is the way to go forward, and they will constitute a very potent source of demand the next time there's a major terrorist attack. So those are the five ways that demand can come into a democracy. First, through national emergencies. Second, through local arrangements. Third, through permissive judicial systems. Fourth, through decommissioned officers returning from war. And fifth, from those who seek to have careers within security forces and are drawn to them because they believe the torture works. So that's the issue of demand. Let me turn now then to the question of supply. Now, you might think, when you think about torture, that this comes out of the sadistic imagination of torture. If I ask you, how would you torture someone, you'd say, well, you'd try and imagine the most horrible thing that you could do to them. But the studies that we have of torturers, and I have several friends who interview torturers and talk to them and so forth from many countries, tell us something quite different. Torturers are not sadists. They're very normal people. They're usually chosen to do their job because they're loyal, they're patriotic, they're obedient, and they can keep secrets well. And in fact, organizations that torture don't like sadists because the problem is that if you torture for pleasure, you don't obey the rules. And there's nothing that bothers these organizations more than people who don't obey the rules. And I'm not making a point about, say, Latin American or American cases. The case I'm thinking of right now is during the Cambodian genocide. We actually have, it's one of the few places in the world where we actually have the entire torture complex intact. It's called the Tuol Sleng Interrogation Center, now the Tuol Sleng Genocide Museum. And one of the things that survived is the manual that was used during the course of the genocide in the course of torture. And in it, the man who wrote, who organized the torture interrogations at Tuol Sleng keeps on saying, we have to keep the sadists out. You shouldn't get overexcited about pain. You have to stick to the rules. Otherwise, we'll kill them and we won't get the confessions we want. And that is certainly true, which is that regardless of whether your aim is confession, interrogation for information, whatever the goal is that the person remain alive. And the problem was that the interrogators at Tuol Sleng were killing their victims. And I think at this point close to 10,000 people went through Tuol Sleng. So this whole idea that torturers are sadists is not exactly what the social science tells us. Quite the contrary. Torture appears to be something like a craft, and I hope this is not an example given in bad taste, but it's similar to massage or tailoring. And I use these two crafts because they're very close to bodies. You can get bad massages and bad tailors who do one size fits all, or you can get those who try to do individual fits. And so too with torture, you can get the really crude torturer who does the one size fits all, or you can get the extremely skilled, highly individualized approach. And the second point, and this comes out very clearly with the comparison with massage, is that torturers turn out to have styles. That's one of the central arguments of torture and democracy. Torturers turn out to be creatures of habit, and they induct people into their group by saying, this is how we do it here. To put it another way, one of the really striking features of the history of torture is that torturers typically combine the same sets of techniques over time for decades, and they don't change except in certain periods. I'm happy to tell you what those periods look like. But that's one of the things that I'm actually covering tonight. To understand the question of styles, I need to introduce you to my methodology here. 12 years ago, I began the very difficult project of mapping, actually it's not 12 now, is it? Maybe 14 years ago. I began the very difficult project of mapping how torture technology spread around the globe over the last 200 years. My goal was not to do it country by country, which is what had been done for many, many decades, but to just study one technique as if though it was a thread and watch that technique as it traveled around the world. Who used it? When? How did it spread? What were its effects? Now, this is extremely unpleasant work. For example, you have to ask yourself the torture called the leg clamp. How does that work? And when was it first used? Well, it turns out it was first used by the Gestapo in interrogations in the 1940s. And then it spread in a broad arc through northern France and Belgium and Holland and Norway and Denmark. But Gestapo officers in Eastern Europe didn't like using it. Now, this might sound very peculiar and archival, but the fact is that we know very little about how torture techniques change, and my goal was to understand how they did change. In fact, it's what we would call in sociology a standard study of diffusion of techniques. Now, this work yielded a very surprising conclusion. With some rare exceptions, very few modern techniques originated with the Nazis, the Stalinists, or the Inquisition. The pattern turned out to be very weird and unexpected. What has driven torture technology turns out to be something that no one considers having anything to do with torture, namely international monitoring and democracy. And to make this plausible to you, let me distinguish between two types of techniques: techniques that leave marks and techniques that do not. Simple enough. Now, over the last two centuries, the more scarring techniques are disappearing. The leg clamp, which I described, has not been described in torture accounts by anybody anywhere in the world since 1945. It has disappeared. And in case you're wondering what it is and why I would call it a scarring technique, it's a clamp that slowly shatters your leg. No big surprise. On the other hand, clean techniques, techniques that leave no marks, were spreading. And there were two main clean styles, that is, combinations of techniques that repeatedly went together. The first technique I've called French modern, and the second technique I call Anglo-Saxon modern. French modern is a classic combination of electricity and water, and it leaves very few marks. Now, specific versions of the water torture and the electro torture that the French used, the magneto torture, were documented slightly earlier. U.S. Marines in Haiti, I have now been told by a young graduate student, actually used some of these techniques earlier. But this specific combination of water and electricity really was a French technique. And it appeared in Vietnam in 1931 and then passed on to the Nazis through the Vichy police in southern France near Toulouse, a man by the name of Inspector Marty, and from then it spread around the world. Anglo-Saxon modern is older, and a combination of sleep deprivation, exhaustion, exercises, forced standing. This combination comes from a variety of different sources again. Some are traditional British and French military punishments that were banned by the 1820s. Some were from American prison practice in the 19th century, and some actually come from the global slave trade. This last one requires a bit of explanation. There are, for example, ways of striking someone repeatedly with your hands for hours without leaving any bruises. I know that's kind of hard to contemplate, but it can be done. And the most famous case actually was a case in which four doctors saw the victim afterwards and couldn't identify any marks. So we're not talking about things that are very specialized. The global slave traders actually preferred techniques like this for a very particular reason, which was that when you sell a slave, the buyer looks to the slave to see if there are any marks. And if there are marks, that will reduce the price of your slave. So while we associate whipping with slavery, that's only true for owners. If you were selling slaves, you were clean. And you didn't want to destroy the price of your cargo. So let me just be clear that the techniques I'm talking about are painful techniques. Sleep deprivation, you may have heard about this, isn't simply depriving people of their naps. And for those of you who are, I understand it's the end of the quarter and are depriving yourselves of sleep, you may want to pay attention to some of these particular features. If you have been depriving yourself of sleep for a significant amount of time, you will discover that your aches, there will be aches in your muscular skeletal joints, first in your legs and then in your upper body. The other problem is that pulling all-nighters, if you will make you much more sensitive to pain caused by anything touching you, including and especially electricity punches and heat. So, not surprisingly, sleep deprivation is an ideal supplement if you're going to apply other painful techniques. And that's one of the reasons why I include sleep deprivation as a painful technique, because it's not just a psychological tool. It just doesn't leave marks. So normally, this is where I actually take a moment to talk about the history of torture in the local area where I'm speaking. When I was speaking in Canada, I had this very long list. But I couldn't find anything for Nebraska. So you guys are good. But I will pass on that and move on to a much more broader point. Now, if one maps how clean techniques appear, there is a surprising conclusion, which is this. Wherever we watch, torturers become sneaky. Wherever there's a free press, church groups, politicians who watch the police, and interrogators literally pull their punches. Electro-torture is relatively unknown for most of the 20th century, except in two countries, the United States and France and Vietnam. And for a lot of extremely good reasons, because electricity, though you might think of it as a straightforward technique, is not. It's much easier to beat someone with your hands than risk killing them with electricity. Electro-torture really doesn't start spreading until a series of engineering problems get solved by torturers over a period of 30 or 40 years. And at that point, it starts spreading very rapidly. And this spread begins in the 1960s. And after that, the contagion effect is huge, doubling virtually every decade. So it starts first in Latin America in the 1960s, then the Middle East and Asia, then Africa in the 80s, and then Southern and Eastern Europe in the 90s. Now, why all this obsession with clean techniques? What has made things like electricity so common that when we think of torture, that's usually the first torture that anybody thinks about? And the answer is this. What makes clean techniques valuable is that allegations of torture are simply less credible when there is nothing to show for it. If you can't show a visible wound or the photograph of actual torture, who are you actually going to believe? The whole utility of clean torture is this, that it breaks down the ability to communicate between victims and their wider communities, including their families and their lawyers. And that's exactly what stealthy tortures are calculated to subvert, those relationships. And not surprisingly then, there is a very close correlation between how clean techniques spread and how intensive human rights monitoring happens. Because the global age of human rights monitoring begins in the 1960s. It begins with Amnesty International in 1961, the Greek crisis in 1967, the first Amnesty International report in 72, and after that, Human Rights Watch, and a whole series of other things. And frankly, it builds on a very important psychological point, which is that people judge more by what they see than what they hear. Would Americans have been as outraged by Abu Ghraib without the pictures? It's a legitimate question, but actually we already know the answer to that. Because Army charged the first defendants in January of 2004. Reuters had a story on it in February 2004. The first trials began in March of 2004, but it was only at the end of April 2004 when the pictures appeared on national news that there was a torture crisis. So that's briefly my history of torture and its supply. I'm halfway through, and that was pretty grim. Let me talk to you about two other things now, the question of whether torture works and American public opinion. Now, before I launch into the question of whether torture works, I want to begin by saying that this is a very complicated question. In my book, I actually lay out 9 specific questions that need to be answered to answer this question properly. And I also want to be clear that the question of when most people ask, does it work, that they're not really asking about, does torture work to get me a good false confession? Although I can tell you what the rates for that are. Because the question of does it work means for what purpose? You know, does it work to intimidate people? Does it work to get a false confession? Usually what people mean is something a lot narrower, which is does it get true or accurate information in a timely way? Something along those lines. So let me begin by saying I'm only going to be addressing a very narrow part of the question, which is of interest to audiences in the United States. Let me also say that the way I'm going to approach this is not by trying to raise the question and go through all the detailed points, but I'll just begin with, I think, a relatively straightforward point that I think we can all agree on, which is that for the foreseeable future, most of the challenges that we as Americans are likely to face in the world are going to be asymmetrical conflicts in which people will not be fighting us with full armies, but will be attacking us in the form of insurgents and terrorist attacks. That's going to be the reality of it. And so within this context, we need a good counterterrorism policy because there will be unquestionably people who will want to hurt us. And then the only question that follows from that is good torture really good counterterrorism policy? That's really the question I want to think about and briefly go over. And I think it's not going to surprise you if I come to this conclusion that good torture might work once in a while, but it's really lousy counterterrorism policy. And I'm going to choose some very unlikely allies to make my point to you, namely the Japanese fascist Kempei Tai, the military police, and the Gestapo. These are the people on my side of the question. Let me begin with a manual that Allied forces found in Burma in 1943 at a Japanese prison camp. It is a Japanese interrogation manual for the Kempei Tai. And this was a very brutal military police that did not hesitate to use torture to get false confessions or to intimidate people. But on the subject of torture for interrogation, the manual states, torture is the clumsiest method, and it makes a fool of those who are prepared to use it. Now, let me just clarify that for the purposes of answering this question, what's really important is to understand whether this or that physically coercive technique works. It doesn't matter what you call these techniques, torture, not torture, tough stuff, muffin stuff, none of this matters to me. The only thing that really matters in terms of answering this question is, does it work to get accurate information and the bad guys? And usually when this question arises, and I have been on television many times, and I've heard this dozens of times from others, there's usually someone who tells some story about how torture worked for them, and you know, someone tells a story of how it didn't work in another context. So I'm going to share with you a story that's not a ticking time bomb story, but it's a story that really did happen. It happened at a talk not unlike the one we're having today. A World War II veteran came up to me at the end of my talk, and he said, you know, in France, when we caught some German soldier, we put a knife to his throat and said, where are the other soldiers? And I said, yes, and did you get good information? And he said, yeah, sorta. And I said, well, I am very happy for you. I really am. Because actually, if you had gotten bad information on that day, you would be dead. You would be dead. If you had gotten bad information, if that soldier had lied to you and you had gone in the wrong place, you would be dead. The problem with torture is that when you think about this question, is that everyone who knows that these physically coercive techniques don't work to get information is dead. Those for whom it worked are walking around saying it worked for me. In social science, there's a technical word for it. It's called a biased selection sample. So at this point, I'm going to leave testimonies aside because they're no good. And I'm going to look at some statistical cases where we had armies who tried to use torture in the most efficient way that they could to get information and were marginally successful. And here's the bottom line. In all these cases, and Torture and Democracy covers the three main cases where we have statistics, soldiers tried to arrest in the most professional and scientific way they could. And the best results that they got when they approached close to 8,000 to 20,000 or more individuals that they arrested and tortured most of them. So that's your minimum for good results, 8,000 to 20,000. And in this best case scenario, when you do the math, it turned out that they tortured between 20 and 78 innocent people for each bad guy they got, each person who really had information to give them. That, as close as we can tell, is the error rate for torture. So for every accurate piece of information, one has to torture in the thousands, even if you're trying to be professional about it. So when people raise the ticking time bomb case with me, my view is that, well, that's just a fairy tale. It actually appears in a novel in the Algerian War, but it never happened in the Algerian War. The Algerian War demonstrated a very basic point about counterterrorism policy. Good torture, if you want to use it as counterterrorism policy, is always wholesale. It is never retail. Good not torture, whatever you want to call it, also is going to be wholesale. It's never going to be retail business. So does that mean that torture works? Well, let me give you the opinion of the professional Gestapo on whether torture works. In 1942, the Czech resistance assassinated Reinhard Heydrich, Reichsprotector of Czechoslovakia. Hitler wanted results, and he didn't care how. And the Gestapo went on a rampage. They captured the assassins, the three of them. But to capture those three, they tortured and killed 7,542 people, including annihilating two villages. By accident, and they weren't looking for these people, they also captured 100 resistance members. And that is a very, very typical result. Now, in the middle of all this, Heinz von Panwitz arrives. He was a career policeman and the head of the Gestapo's anti-sabotage unit in Prague. He was Mr. Counterterrorism. And he said, don't be stupid. Depend on public cooperation. You need to use rapport-building interrogation, put out a reward. They received over 1,000 tips. And what broke the case, what identified the three guys in the end, was when Kurda, a member of the Czech resistance, betrayed the entire resistance organization. Kurda wasn't tortured. He lived very well. He collected a gigantic reward that the Gestapo gave him, and he lived to enjoy it at least till 1947 when he was tried and executed for treason. The professional Gestapo repeatedly decimated the resistance during World War II through a combination of public cooperation and informers. That is what the record shows. And my 3 years in the Holocaust Museum, I will never forget. Because when I walked up there, nobody knew anything about what the Gestapo did. In France, Denmark, Poland, Norway, Russia, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and in the camps, the Gestapo constantly won against the resistance by using very standard policing techniques. The Gestapo's turn to torture, for which they are famous in the movies, happened when they lost their seasoned pros like Panwitz during the war, when these guys died in some of the initial battles. And after that, people were promoted who were young, who liked shiny boots and whips, and why learn good policing when you've got a whip? Now, since World War II, huge government-funded studies, our government studies included, Canadian studies, British studies, have proved that the Gestapo, particularly von Panwitz, was right. If you don't have public cooperation, the chances that a crime is solved falls to less than 10%. And so, does torture work? Well, if the professional Gestapo concluded that public cooperation really is the best anti-terrorist method, why would you argue differently? So one of the key points that people raise at this point is, well, public cooperation is slow. Actually, it's not slow at all. It works extremely well when time is short. London, July 21st, 7 men boarded buses with ticking bombs. The British police captured all of them within 1 week and the ticking time bomb lying in the bush. The big break came within 24 hours when the parents of Mukhtar Said Ibrahim saw their son on a security video aired by the British police over television. Question, would British, loyal British Muslims have turned their son in to the British if they knew that the police would torture them? And the answer is no. And this is a very critical point. Good torture doesn't just have a very high error rate. It destroys the only thing we really know works well against terrorist threat, which is public cooperation. Good rapport weakens even the strongest bonds we know, the connection between parents and child, even when time is short. In fact, I'm keeping up a list of parents who've turned in their children to European authorities. At this point, it's going up to 5. The FBI report on counterterrorism that came out 2 years ago identified that 1/3 of all terror cases were broken by tips from the Muslim community. Lastly, for those of you who are really interested in something fun, there's the DARPA Red Balloon Project. For those of you who know the Defense Advanced Research Project of the military, they had a test. They wanted to test out public cooperation, and they put out 10 red balloons for 1 day in 10 American cities. And they promised I think it was $30,000 prize to whichever group of people were able to identify all 10 red balloons. And the press people went up to them and they said, why are you doing this? Why are you wasting taxpayer monies on red balloons? And they said, oh, we don't know. Supposing this is a large-scale, time-critical thing that's in several American cities, like a bomb. So how fast would it take before people could find it? Well, we now know the answer to that, 9 hours. And the algorithm was established by a group at MIT. Now, public cooperation is exactly the way we got Zaghawi in Iraq. It's a very powerful tool, and when you torture, you essentially make yourself more and more powerless. So torture feeds on itself. The less public cooperation you get, the more you're likely to torture, and the cycle at that point becomes uncontrollable. This is why Petraeus, in his counterinsurgency memo, makes it quite clear that the most important thing that you can do in counterinsurgency is to establish relationships with your local communities. Without that, you are in trouble. Now, so we know what really works. Public cooperation and professional interviews so people defect over. Using these techniques, Matthew Alexander managed to capture Zaghawi in Iraq. And using these techniques, the British managed to identify all 290 Nazi spies that crossed the channel among 42,000 refugees during World War II without torturing any of them. Now, I haven't spoken about the specific techniques, the things that we call not torture, like sleep deprivation. But let me just say, I don't care whether you call torture, call sleep deprivation torture or not torture for this question. I just want to tell you a bit of its Catholic history. The Inquisition didn't like sleep deprivation. Actually, most Spanish inquisitors wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, because they knew that sleep deprivation has a hypnotic effect. It's very ideal if you want to generate visions of pacts with the devil, and people remember shooting Kennedy from behind the grassy knoll if you ask them about it repeatedly and they're lacking sleep. That is why Scottish witch hunters and New England witch hunters really like sleep deprivation as a method of getting at the truth. But what they actually got was their own questions confirmed back at them. And as the Catholic inquisitors observed, that's those crazy Protestants. They knew that this stuff wasn't reliable, and it's really quite remarkable when you read the Spanish inquisitors. It's one of those moments where they go, you know, I'd rather use the rack than do that. And I just want to be clear on this point. We use sleep deprivation all the time. And we think that it's actually going to get us reliable information. So here's the bottom line. If you really do good torture, you're going to have a major intelligence crisis. You're going to sweep up thousands of innocents. You're going to have a lot of mess to clear through. We also know, and there's a wonderful book that's come out on this, on the soldiers who were involved in torture and exposed to it, who have returned. Not all of them have done very well. There's a book on this now called None of Us Were Like This Before, and we know that people in these brigades have started killing themselves, three of them in this particular brigade. So it destroys the torturers who actually do the work. It has certain slippery slopes, and it creates generally ineffective security. And limited time makes things worse. In short, what we know about torture is that in the few cases where we have been able to determine that it works best when you need it the least, during peacetime, non-emergency situations. And these are typically the classic cases that Alan Dershowitz and other people use to demonstrate the point. This is something that the professional Gestapo knew. This is something that the Japanese Kempei Tai knew. Even occasionally, Spanish inquisitors knew this. So my view is that good counterterrorism really depends on winning public support and building up your human intelligence corps and giving due respect to the military interrogators who actually know what they're doing. So moving on, let me just quickly talk about public opinion as well. So for as long as I've been talking on torture, I've also been watching the public polling. And my colleague Paul Gronke and James Hicks, we've been studying American public opinion on torture. And one of the really interesting things about it is that it's not, again, the secret here is that it's not what you think it is. And one of the really intriguing results of this polling is that, and that the, what's called CCES observations are our own polls that we've done through a number of polling agencies, is that during most of the Bush administration, when I appeared in front of public crowds, and I'd ask, where do you think the average American is on torture, and where do you, people would usually say between 60 and 80% for. But in fact, during most of the Bush administration period, opposition to torture was the majority at about 55 to 58%. And it only starts tightening during the presidential campaign of 2007-2008. And it shifts over in 2008 in the first 6 months of the Obama administration. And during the Obama years, we now have a plurality of Americans for torture. So it's exactly the reverse of what most people think, that most Americans were for torture under Bush and now against torture under Obama. It's actually the reverse. So as I've told you, torture, just to go back to the original point my advisor gave me, what can we say about torture other than it's bad and it should stop? Lots of things. And for me, I could not have asked for a better adventure. And it will probably keep me busy for the rest of my life. But I thank you all for taking time to come and see this talk, and I'd be delighted to take your questions. And John's going to lead us.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Darius Rejali, professor of political science at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and author of Torture and Democracy. Dr. Rejali's talk was given as the Father Henry W. Casper S.J. Professorship in History Lecture, co-sponsored by the Creighton University Department of History. His topic was The Secret Histories of Modern Torture. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 15, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.